Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Hello, and welcome to the Oldie podcast with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie, and I'm delighted to be talking to Graydon Carter, the great editor of Vanity Fair for 25 years, now the editor of Airmail, and he's just published his terrific book, When the Going Was Good, an editor's adventures during the last golden age of magazines. Lovely to have you here.
Lovely to be here, and thank you, Harry.
And I worked out that for most of the last 52 years, you've been an editor. Is that right?
Probably for 47 years of those, right. Yes.
Pretty good.
And I was the youngest when I started of anybody I knew, and I'm the oldest right now.
And do you think you're addicted to the joy of editing?
Well, it doesn't involve extreme manual labor, and it does keep you engaged with the world at least as much as you want to be engaged with this world right now. And you know what it's like. It's fun.
It's incredibly enjoyable.
Yes, yeah. It is.
And why is it so enjoyable?
Well, you're kind of in, I find that, I've always felt myself to be in the service industry in that you get as many wonderful things that you can combine of photographs and stories, writers and photographers and all these elements. You put them together, you design it as best you humanly can, and you deliver it to one reader either once a month or once a week, and you hope they enjoy it and that they come back the next week or the next month. And there's something pleasing about being in the service business. I know most journalists think they have a calling. I don't feel like I have a calling. I literally want to make other people happy for a period that they're or engaged or informed and during the period they either read the weekly thing I have now, Airmail, or Vanity Fair, which is a monthly.
And do you think part of the pleasure I take from editing is the meticulousness? Alexander Chancellor, my predecessor as editor of the Oldie and editor of the Spectator, was an old friend of my dad, Ferdy Mount.
I knew Alexander for years, yes.
Great man. My dad was editor of the TLS, and they were at school together. They never had a row in 60 years, except once, about whether to put the full stop outside the brackets or inside the brackets.
Oh, so interesting. But I think it goes outside the brackets.
I think it normally does, yeah. But it showed the meticulousness is everything, don't you think?
Yeah. I mean, the fact is, editors, it's all about detail. I picked up a new edition of Ross McDonald's, one of Ross McDonald's mysteries, and it was a Penguin edition, and it had a little notice on the front that talked a little bio of Ross McDonald, one paragraph, and it spelled there incorrectly. And I just thought, that's the old Penguin would have, an editor would have caught that.
Yeah.
Not that it ruined the book for me or anything like that, but it being an editor is all about details. And the fact is, if you read four typos in a magazine over a course, you think less of the magazine. You think perhaps less of the factuality of the magazine, because if they're sloppy on copy editing, they might be sloppy elsewhere.
Yeah, and you begin to lose trust. You might quickly lose a reader.
You might quit. Yes, it's easy to lose a reader these days. They're harder to hold on to than they used to be.
And in your book, actually, it's very good guide on how to be an editor, and you sort of refer to the ingredients of the perfect magazine piece, which varies. So you say if there's a scoop in a newspaper story, it's often in the first sentence. If there's a scoop in a weekly magazine story, it's generally in the first paragraph. So they vary. In a long form magazine piece, the scoop could be in the 17th paragraph. So they vary from piece to piece. But did you come up with, as it were, the perfect piece? Your famous one was the Vanity Fair piece that identified Mark Felt as Deep Throat.
Well, that was sort of perfect in the fact that it showed we played a long game. It took 2 years to put together, and it made news. It made the front page of newspapers all over the world the next morning, and also the fact is we weren't 100% sure we had the right identity of the man who was Deep Throat, the secret source for Bob Woodward during his and Carl Bernstein's Watergate reporting about Richard Nixon. And we were about 95% sure, and that 5% it was at a time during the Bush administration where if you made an error in journalism, the Republicans would really come down on you, as would the Democrats. They're nitpickers on both sides. And so it was especially pleasing. And it happened to, we released the story the day I was coming back from my honeymoon. And I was in the Bahamas, and I didn't have a cell phone in those days. And but my wife did, and I completely forgot that we were releasing the story to the world that morning. And it was a very tense waiting time in the Nassau airport. And just before we got on the plane, we found out that Woodward and Bernstein confirmed that it was Deep Throat. And that made it a very pleasurable ride back to New York. And as I say, the next morning it was on the front page of newspapers all over the world. But it was a two-year process. You know, it wasn't something that we cooked up overnight.
And you also had to do a massive security secrecy campaign, didn't you? Because here it is, the magazine's being printed, has to be delivered to newsstands, all the rest of
it. Well, also, my competition rode up and down the elevators with my staff. You know, we had like magazines like The New Yorker and GQ, which would have loved to, or you know, to have that story. So I always used to tell the junior staff, don't talk on the elevator, because your chances are you're standing beside a competitor. And when you're at a restaurant, because young people in New York, the restaurant tables are the size of, you know, cribbage boards. And I said, don't use code words when you're at a restaurant, when you're talking about the office of the magazine or a story you're working on. So it was, and I wanted to keep it from the rest of the company. I didn't want even the executives to know about this, because they would, you know, maybe have too much to drink and talk about it over dinner with their friends. So it was complete secrecy. We did it offline, and it was the first story we ever released digitally. This was 2005. Normally, we would wait till the magazine was just about to hit the newsstand, but we were afraid that if we waited that long, because you know how what it's like, you've got to color correct it, print it, bind it, ship it, wait for the newsstand people to open it all across the country. And remember, in America, it's a lot bigger than Britain, so there's a long wait for some of these newsstands. So we released it digitally, and it was the first time we'd ever done that. So it was sort of the beginning of the modern world for us in terms of how to release news stories.
And in terms of trying to find the perfect magazine piece, that's pretty good. Then there's also the perfect combination of different pieces in a magazine. Did you come up with almost like a formula for the perfect Vanity Fair issue?
Well, I do like to see, I think, a great long form stories, and our stories would run, you know, 8,000. They could be 20,000. We'd run 21,000 words. If it's well crafted and it has narrative thrust, a reader just can plow right through it. But I think you do need a narrative arc to a story, sort of a beginning, middle, and end. You need conflict, and it's always best when two people are fighting over one thing than one person fighting over one thing. You need a disclosure, that is, you know, fresh information on the subject, and you need access to either the principal characters or the people around the principal characters. And if you get 3 out of 4, you have a good chance. But if you get 4 out of 4, you're going to hit the bullseye.
And also, you need to combine different themes. You talk about having an arresting cover, current history, feuds, scoops, scandals from literature, art, fashion, show business, politics, Wall Street, and Silicon Valley, and a dispatch from foreign trouble spots. So that's quite a brilliant, difficult range to get, isn't it?
Well, Vanity Fair, in some way, was the last general interest magazine. I don't know whether that's an expression over here, but weekly magazine, excuse me, by and large reports on the week that just happened. A monthly magazine, you can't do that, because your chances are the stories you have in it, we started work on them, you know, 6 months or 2 years ago. So monthly magazines have to carve out their worldview, their pie-shaped view of the world. And that's what Vanity Fair's was. And it meant that the whole world was your oyster. You could run a sports story, you could run a literary story, you could run a political story. But you had to make them compelling, and you had to make it the whole issue come together like a choir rather than a bunch of discordant voices.
And you also have to be quite tough with the big names. There's a very good story about you having to spike Norman Mailer.
Yeah, that was, yes, okay. So this is one of the great writers in American journalism, and a legend, and And I had to, he had turned a story in. This is my first or second week. He'd turned a story in on the Democratic convention in New York City in 1992, in the summer of 1992. And he turned the story in, and it was completely lacking in disclosure. It was lacking in any kind of just fresh information. It was just as if he'd been watching television the whole night, the way I had watched it. And I killed that. I paid him for the full amount, for the full fee.
Which was $150,000?
$50,000.
I'm still pretty good.
And then I canceled. He was going to do the Republican convention in, I think, Houston later that summer. And I killed that as well. And it was just, it may be the stupidest thing I ever did. I should have just published the damn thing. I paid for it. But I thought it just wasn't good enough. And this was my first issue.
And you happened to see him, I think, on TV at one of the conventions, didn't you?
I did. I saw
he wasn't doing his job. There.
He was gabbing away in the expensive bleachers with a bunch of other sort of notables.
Because some of the grand writers get too big for their boots. You write brilliantly about Dominic Dunn, the terrific crime writer that he became stupidly grand. Is that right?
He became a bit grand, and would be rude to the younger assistants, which did not really work for me. He was cranky but wonderful doing what he did so well. But he'd had an up and down life. He'd had been an alcoholic. I think he'd had a drug problem. He had been way up in Hollywood and way down in Hollywood. And I think he loved being back up. He was probably the most famous print journalist in the world during the O.J. Simpson trial. He was on TV. TV can really, excuse me, I think TV can ruin you, because I think all of a sudden you start getting noticed in airports and on street corners, and I think he loved that, and it sort of fills a hole that nothing else can, and it becomes a bit like crack cocaine, and you start thinking you're bigger than normal people, and Dominic did, and so it actually... His addiction to television ultimately became his downfall, because he started saying things that weren't true, got sued, and it really sort of it ended his writing career in a certain way, because he became all consumed with defending these libel cases.
And started saying the world's worst question, do you know who I am?
That is the world's worst question. Although Nikki Haslam says the two worst words in the English language are tasting menu, which I think is really funny and very accurate.
Genius.
Yes.
A genius. And you also had to deal with some pretty good monsters, including one you nicknamed the short-fingered Vulgarian. Can you explain who that is and how you first came across him?
I've been assigned by a magazine in 1983 to do a story on this sort of slightly flashy, up-and-coming New York real estate developer who spent a lot of time in the pages of the New York tabloids, the Daily News and the New York Post. And it was Donald Trump, and I knew just a little bit about him through the tabloid stories. And he... So I spent 3 weeks with him. I wrote the story, and I sort of, portrayed him not completely flatteringly. And I did have a sentence in there that said that his hands were too small for his body. Well, he really didn't like that. And so it said they were very nicely groomed, though. So he didn't like that. So you flash forward 5 years, and at Spy Magazine, which we very much modeled the voice on 1950s era Time Magazine, a magazine both myself and my co-founder worked at, not in the 50s, but in the 70s, and Private Eye. And we had epithets for, sort of rude epithets for a recurring cast of characters. And like Larry Tisch, who was a developer and a raider, financial raider, who bought CBS, which was then the best network in America. We called him a churlish dwarf billionaire, which did not go down well with him or his people. And we called Donald Trump a short-fingered Bulgarian, which he really hated. And once he discovered Twitter, he went after me in on an almost daily basis. He would call me sloppy. He would call me dopey. He said my wife said I was a total loser. He said the magazine was failing, that the Vanier Oscar party was no longer HOT, and then, of course, HOT would be capitalized. He said that the Waverly Inn, a restaurant I'm part owner of, has the worst food in the city, and so we've had that as a quote at the top of the menu for the, that was about 15 years ago, but for the past 15 years, and business has never been better as a result of it.
And you think you might be responsible for his rise to power?
Well, then the. Yes, in a butterfly's wing sort of way. He hated the story I'd done on him so much. It was for GQ magazine in America, that he had his staff go out and buy as many copies as he could off the New York newsstands. Cy Newhouse, who I worked for at Vanity Fair, he owned Condé Nast, which was Vanity Fair, Vogue, The New Yorker, GQ. He also owned Random House, which also owned, you know, Alfred A. Knopf and Pantheon. He saw that the newsstand sales in New York were so strong for that GQ cover that he then spoke to the head of Random House and thought a book by Donald Trump should get started on. And the book was The Art of the Deal, which led to that ridiculous reality TV show called, I don't know, it's called The Apprentice or The Celebrity Apprentice or something like that. And that led to the White House. So... the smallest responsibility.
Ah. And what do you think fundamentally makes him tick? Do you think he's got narcissistic personality disorder?
Oh, my God. All politicians do. I mean, let's face it. And but his is exponential. And I think that this, you know, America's become third world the grift that's going on, and third world in terms of the courtier aspect of the White House, those cabinet ministers have to, you know, bend the knee on every meeting and say how wonderful he is. I'm sure the same thing happens in North Korea and obviously in Moscow, and It's upsetting for most people. And I came to America 50 years ago. I was born in Canada, and so I chose to become an American. And I don't recognize this country as opposed to the country I came in 1978.
And as you say, you're born in Canada. What do you think his game is in theory, trying to take over Canada, which is not going to happen?
I think that might have been. I think he just loves owning the news cycle. And maybe it was a down period where he had nothing to say that day. And he really does love just owning the news cycle, for good and bad. I think this is just something he said to annoy Justin Trudeau, because clearly there was animosity between the two of them. I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think Americans want it. And I know that Canadians don't want it.
Because Trump fans always try to reverse engineer it and say there's some brilliant scheme. Actually, very often it's just an instinctive... off-the-cuff remark, isn't it?
Yes, he's not the brightest person in the world, but he thinks he is. And, of course, the person who thinks he is the brightest is obviously not the brightest person in the world. And he's sort of America in the extreme. Like, the way Americans are basically a very decent people. I mean, the fact is America has been a welcome home for immigrants, and, you know, the forlorn for, you know, 150 years, not through its entire lifetime, but certainly since the late 19th century, I mean, the Statue of Liberty. And so that we are, not only turning people away, but treating people who have made it here and have worked and raised families, treating them so horribly is heartbreaking.
And do you think, as a Canadian, you came over to America and then became... in a way, the ultimate insider. But you think, as a Canadian, I always think outsider insiders are always the most interesting people, often make the best journalists. Do you think that gave you an element of detachment?
Yes. I think that if you grow up in New York City, you get used to everything. You don't see why it's extraordinary, what makes it different than, say, another city like Denver or Chicago. But if you grow, if you come to New York as an adult, and I came when I was in my late 70s, mid to late 70s, that you become a sponge. Everything is novel. I mean, just everything is different than the place I came from, which was Ottawa, which is the sort of very pleasant but sleepy capital of Canada. Very post-Edwardian and sort of gray. And so it and most editors who made their name in New York came from far away. They came from, you know, the Midwest or the West, and because they see the city in a way that others don't, that others who grew up in this other little, or New York or the sort of sophisticated, you know, pockets around the city don't see it. Also, if you're Canadian, you see all of America in a way that Americans don't. Americans always looked like, when I was growing up, they looked like they were better looking, they were having more fun, their girlfriends were better looking, the weather was nicer, you know, everything. I mean, America just looked like they were like in magazines and we were on, you know, newsletters.
And also richer. One of the fascinating things about your book is the huge amount of money you can pay writers. And this is principally because of massive advertising, is it, or circulation?
Yes, we paid writers really well. We had about 50 writers on contract, and some of them made, you know, they were making, a number of them made $500,000 a year. But, say, Nick Dunn, when he was doing the O.J. Simpson trial, we would put him up at the Chateau Marmont in Los Angeles for 9 months. He'd had a car and driver because he wasn't, you know, I don't think he was comfortable driving in L.A. traffic. And, you know, he paid for all his meals and his, you know, laundry and all the rest of it. So it would come, the bill would be huge, but the advertisers clamored to be around his dispatches. And his dispatch would run, say, 6 or 7 pages. And we'd probably put 12 pages of advertising in that. And the advertising pages in those days went for about $100,000 a page. So even with this huge expense, we made an enormous profit on Dominic. The expenses, the economies of a big successful magazine are really wonderful. If it's, once it starts failing, they become really terrible.
And is that the reason why you left after 25 years?
I sort of read the writing on the wall that the way the internet sort of, the internet came in and chewed up newspapers first. Then it chewed up weekly magazines, because if you're in the information or news business, the internet's going to kill you. Monthly magazines, especially something like Vanity Fair, was in the sort of, we were in the feature business, and the feature business with great photography that doesn't, looks better in a magazine than it does on your phone. So the last issue I produced, which I think was like March 2018, it had like 200 and some odd pages of advertising. So it was hugely profitable right to the end. But I'd been there for 25 years. I'd done everything I wanted to do. Wasn't getting along with Anna Winter that much. She kept wanting to commandeer my staff, and I didn't want to do that because I'd worked with them for a quarter of a century. And I was tired.
Had you never got on with Anna Winter?
I had always gotten along with Anna Winter.
But she then suddenly became...
You know, power can do... You know, I mean, power... I mean, this is like... It's like Brewertanius. You know, those people that like titles this long, but the principalities are the size of a cookie plate. And so, her title just gets longer and longer. She changed a bit. She just became less a great friend and a very sort of cozy, comforting friend to somebody who just, you know, strides through the halls and is, you know, has command.
Oh, yes, how sad. And then you went on to edit the extremely enjoyable weekly online newsletter Airmail, which actually I think has very many of the similar ingredients of terrific range of subjects and deeply compelling writing. Is it quite similar, essentially, editing an online newsletter?
It's sort of, in a funny way, the weekly pace really agrees with me. I never thought it would. Because, you know, on Tuesday you have to have this done. By Wednesday at 11 o'clock you have to have that done. With the monthly magazine, as you know, there's no schedule to speak of at all. Everything's just calamitous all the time. So weeklies, in a funny way, is more orderly. It's long enough, it's short enough that I can still edit every single story. I was in France, and I thought I could put together a dispatch of stories that are not in the American papers. And most of the people at the top at Airmail are from Vanity Fair, so it does have similar DNA. And the book section is edited by my best friend, who started off at Time with me in 1978. Started off a week before I did. He became the editor of Time when I was the editor of Vanity Fair, and so it's like, you know, old timers and rookies, and it works well. And I'm then we found, I don't want to hear anything bad about the new generation. They're wonderful young people. If you choose right, you've got smart and they're energetic, and I'm sure you feel the same way.
Yes, yeah. And there's quite a lot of British content. American readers like that, particularly The Gift That Gives on Giving, Prince Harry, but also A Scandal Here in Britain will work over among American readers.
Yeah, well, it depends on the person. Yeah, so the royal family, I find them I saw the King and Queen on the way here.
Oh, really?
Yes, in that beautiful Rolls Royce with the enormous windows.
Oh, funny.
Literally
they
6 feet away
you.
From me. They came to see me. And I find that basically the royal family is only interesting when the wheels are coming off. I'm sorry to say that, too.
No, it's completely
in this wonderful
gripping.
Sitting
that
country.
Is compelling. And also when they're producing so much material.
Oh, my God.
Harry and Meghan can't stop speaking.
I think the tabloids have gone to business with the royal family.
Yeah.
And then you got the second royal family, the Beckhams, and they're following in the same footstep of, you know, the son I'm making a bolt for. I find, well, family dynamics are always about the most interesting thing in the world
and
anyway.
Thus, the Murdoch fallout is fantastic. Yeah.
Actually, that's true. Your three major families have had brothers falling out. Murdochs, whatever you call them, Sussexes, and the Beckhams. Interesting.
Yes. No, it's Cain and Abel, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes.
Yeah. And in your book, you've got some very enjoyable list of banned words. You basically hate pretentiousness. A restaurant must be a restaurant, not a what. A book must never be a tome.
I'm sure you feel the same.
Oh, huge amount of bad words.
No, I inherited this incredibly baroque sort of writing style at Vanity Fair, and it just took me months of wearing out manuscripts with pencil, because I always edited with a pencil, and just eliminating that. Then I thought, okay, that's it. I'm creating a banned book list with a copy chief. And so it just first started off with about 25 words. It probably has 150 now. I don't even like the word celebrity in airmail. I hate expressions like A-list. And anyway.
Well, they're basically genteel euphemisms. I agree with all of them. Donned.
Like
coiffed,
for putting on eatery. A hat. Yes. No, yeah. They're just, yeah. I mean, they should not belong in any magazine anywhere.
And you're extremely obsessed with these things and an extremely good writer. Why did you bring in James Fox, the brilliant journalist, as a co-writer on your book?
Because he brought it up. We were having lunch at, I think, Colbert. And I was in London. It's about 7 years ago. And James and I had worked together. He'd written a lot of Vanity Fair, and we were friends. And he said, if you ever write a memoir, I'd love to help you. And I honestly had never, ever thought of it. And then we had a couple of other meetings, and then he sort of walked me through what I would need for a proposal. I had a really good agent. And James was very good. He's got a great sort of work habit, and he kept me busy because I'm sort of lazy. I mean, I wake up.
Don't believe that.
I actually am. I wake up at the light. My wife doesn't understand. I have a nap every afternoon, I mean, for 25 minutes. And I read a lot, just, you know, mysteries and things. So he sort of helped me with the organization, because you can't do it in a strict linear fashion. And he made it more fun. I'm not a solitary sort of, you know, writer in the lonely garret sort of person. So we worked on it in New York. We worked on it here. We worked on it. I have a house in Connecticut. We worked on it there. And you just made it highly enjoyable. I love James's company.
And by chatting about it, you come up with new ideas.
It was really good. You know, I have a partner at Airmail. I had a partner at Spy Magazine. I'm a partner sort of person. I have a wife.
Yeah. Yeah. Just to make it clear.
Yes.
And you've also, as you said, have your restaurant, and you've done documentaries, and you talk in your book about the need to always do new things and always be curious, which I think is at the heart of being a journalist, too.
To be up for new things, for saying, you know, it depends on, I mean, like when I was, when my Canadian magazine was struggling, and we just did nothing but lose money. It was catastrophic. And my best friend then, Bruce McLennan, he came by the office one day. He said, this magazine was called the Canadian Review. It was a sort of lame political literary magazine. And he came by and said, why don't you call it the Canadian Review and have pictures of naked women in it? And I thought, you know, I thought, no, I think I'm going to have kids at some point. They're not going to want to know that their father was once a pornographer. But by and large, I always feel, you know, be willing to. I was out having dinner at Elaine's one night with a neighbor in Greenwich Village. And we noticed that the restaurant right in between the two of us, called the Waverly Inn, was for sale. And we had a bit too much to drink, and we decided to buy it. We've never run a restaurant before. Neither of us could cook. And so we bought it the next day. And we brought in professional people to be our partners. And we've had it now more than 20 years. It's been enormously successful. But it was all based on a sort of slightly lubricated evening at Elaine's and saying, oh, what the hell, let's do it.
But still a bit, perhaps, like commissioning a piece. You had a pretty good hunch. I mean, that's a beautiful part of Manhattan, isn't it, that it would be a good idea?
Yes and no. The restaurant business is the most brutal business in the world, probably, you know, second only to the airline business. It's just brutal. But I wanted a restaurant that was... The most Italian restaurants in New York and Greenwich Village were Italian, because Italian food is really inexpensive to make. A bowl of pasta, a plate of pasta, costs them about $3 to make, but they can charge you $25. You put a $25 steak on the plate, the chances are they cost the restaurant $20. So I wanted American comfort food, which is a bit like English and sort of continental food, and white tablecloths. We had four fireplaces in the place to begin with, and I wanted great cocktails and beautiful lighting. So it's, people like good lighting, especially as you get older, it's everything. And lighting, life is all about seating and lighting. And we had red leather banquettes, and it's a cozy atmosphere, and it's done well.
And a fun place to be. I've been there myself.
Yes, yeah, it's fun.
Yeah. Well, that's a good word to finish our interview with Graydon Carter. Thanks so much for appearing on Radio
Oldie. Oh, no, you're going to let me know. I say that The Oldie is my favorite magazine. And I was going to say... What is it that the two most vibrant magazines in Britain are both were started by the same man, Richard Ingram?
Oh, yes.
I mean, The Eye is you know, crackles every 2 weeks.
And I'm not just fishing for compliments, but what is it about both of them?
There's a first of all, there's sort of an honesty to what the audience. You're not trying to chase an audience. This is what we have, and the audience will find it. And I think in both cases, that's the way it is. And they represent a non Beckham, non Kardashian, you know, non flashy, you know. Teenagers getting drunk, sort of England. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but it's a bit like this room we're sitting in.
Yeah, it's true. I think he is and was amazing. Richard Ingram's the only criterion that matters for an article is that it should be interesting, and that
100%.
Sounds pretty banal. But actually, an awful lot of magazines you read, the editor or the writer is not thinking about, which you say in your book, the poor bloody reader.
I agree. Yep. Because we're getting paid to read and work on these things. The writer, they're paying for the privilege, so you better entertain them.
And they can stop reading at any time.
Yes, they certainly can. They have, with many magazines.
Terrific. Well, thank you so much, Graydon Carter, for appearing on Radio Oldie.
Harry, a great pleasure, and thank you.
You have been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? Sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.